I next met with Dr. Anthony Zeitman, who reviewed with me some of the key clinical trial reports of the past year, particularly in terms of radiation therapy for prostate cancer.
This has been really a very important year in the world of prostate cancer. There have been a couple of huge screening trials that came out in the New England Journal last year that really created a buzz, and I would say have significantly changed the way we think about screening, for one, and treatment, for another. There have been a number of randomized trials looking at therapy. On the one hand, there are studies which show that there are a lot of patients receiving therapy who don't need it at all because they probably cannot benefit. At the opposite end of this disease, there are men who are receiving treatment for whom treatment has been inadequate and needs to improve. I'll start with men with very high-risk prostate cancer. Now, there has been a presumption that if a man is diagnosed with Gleason 9 disease, or he's got a big T3 cancer, he's got a PSA of 20 or 30 or 40, well, he's almost certainly got metastatic disease. And really, the only way we're going to make advances is through systemic therapy. And you can kind of forget the local therapy. It's not important. And certainly, in the United States and elsewhere in the world, it is very common for men with locally advanced disease to receive very good systemic therapy, androgen deprivation, but for that to be the only treatment that they're offered. A big Swedish trial was published in The Lancet last year, and the first author was Anders Widmark. And this took 700 or 800 Swedish men with locally advanced disease, and all men received androgen deprivation, but half the men received radiation therapy in addition. And with approximately 8 years of median follow-up, there was a clear survival advantage to those who had had radiation in addition to their hormonal therapy. Now, that may not necessarily change practice, because I think many men already are receiving radiation with their hormone therapy, but it reminds us that there is a significant survival advantage to be gained through the addition of local therapy. It's gained relatively soon. You can see that survival advantage emerging even at 5 years. And it reminds us that high-risk disease is a nasty disease, even in older men. The majority of these men did have, I think the median age was 67 or 68. Now, that trial has been criticized because the systemic therapy that was used was the only systemic therapy that was available to them in Sweden when the trial was originally designed in the 1990s, and that was flutamide. So flutamide was used as a monotherapy.
So no LHRH agonist?
It was used initially, but not for maintenance. Hmm. So I would agree it is androgen deprivation light, for sure. A new trial that's going to be presented at ASCO later this month comes from a combined Canadian and British group. They've done exactly the same trial, except the androgen deprivation was with an LHRH agonist. So it was the proper trial. They've got over 1,000 patients, and they've got exactly the same results. The addition of local therapy increases survival at 10 years by about something like 10%. Now, you can say, well, 10% is hardly a home run. You've still got the majority of these men dying of prostate cancer. And I would agree with you, it's not a home run. And we need much better systemic therapy. But it reminds us that a local therapy adds substantially.
But, I mean, you know, as you said, isn't that kind of standard of care anyhow?
No, it's not standard of care. It's talked about a great deal, but it's frequently not done.
And you're saying men don't get, what, the radiation therapy part?
Correct. Particularly if they're older men. There has been a presumption that just hormone therapy alone will get the job done. Huh. And if you look at the CAPTCHA database, a significant number of men are receiving hormone therapy alone for locally advanced prostate cancer.
What about radiation therapy, not just in locally advanced disease, but more limited disease? Anything new? We've talked before about proton therapy there, or any other sort of new developments, any new randomized data?
There are lots of new developments in radiation therapy. It's been a wild year for radiation therapy. Anyone who opens their New York Times will know that we've had a lot of unwanted press. And I think some of this has come about as a result of the technological explosion of the last 10 to 15 years. It's been like sort of driving down a highway in a fabulous car at 120 miles per hour. It's thrilling, but it also feels risky. You've got technology exploding and being employed at a rate that is almost faster than our ability to keep up with it. Either our own intellectual ability, our staffing levels in hospitals, and patient demand is driving this as much as vendor pressure, and a desire, of course, by all radiation oncologists to be out on the edge. So in the early 1990s, by the mid-1990s, it was becoming clear that the standard radiation doses we had previously given were insufficient to reliably control the cancer. So we needed to give higher radiation doses. Now, if you're going to give higher radiation doses, that means higher risk. So our treatments just had to be more accurate. And one of the wonderful things about working in the American healthcare system is that we have a very creative system. Our medical technology companies, our pharmaceutical companies, are reimbursed for creativity. And we've had many companies coming up with many ingenious solutions to this high-dose conundrum. We need to give higher doses, but how can we do it more accurately? Proton beam, which we've talked about, is still around. And not only is it still around, a number of new proton centers have opened their doors since last we talked, and many more are either breaking ground or going to open at some stage over the next couple of years. Proton beam has now really established itself as a fabulous way to accurately treat certain tumors, pediatric tumors, brain tumors, spine tumors, tumors in the eye. Unfortunately, there aren't enough patients with these kind of complex cancers to sustain the proton beam facilities. And the economic engine of proton therapy is prostate cancer. There is no doubt that proton beam therapy is a good way to treat prostate cancer. And we've recently published the 10-year results of a study that we've performed using proton beam in prostate cancer. And the results look good, and the morbidity is relatively low. But the biggest question is, do the results look better than with any other kind of radiation therapy? And the answer is probably not. And is the morbidity any lower than with any other kind of modern radiotherapy? And the answer is probably not. So proton beam remains out there. It's a source of great controversy. CMS are wondering what they're going to do about payment for proton beam for prostate cancer. So there's much debate that goes on. There's a huge patient advocacy group and a huge vendor advocacy group. And I'm prepared to believe they may be right. Proton beam may be a superior treatment, but I think it's going to take a good trial to prove it. And we're actually going to start that trial this year.
What's the trial going to do?
It's going to be what you might call current conventional radiation therapy. That's external beam with intensity modulated radiation against proton beam.
What's the size of the facility, of a proton beam facility? I mean, roughly, is it like the size of a football field, or is it like a regular radiation suite, or how big is it?
No, a facility that contains what we call three gantries, three treatment machines, will be about twice the size of your regular radiation oncology department. You can have more gantries than that. You can have just one gantry, and this is a way of reducing costs and reducing the footprint.
What else has happened in the field of radiation oncology and prostate cancer last 6 months or coming up at ASCO that we should know about?
Well, not coming up at ASCO, but certainly something that is of enormous interest is the notion that we can treat prostate cancer patients with a smaller number of radiation doses. Now, this has already been demonstrated very nicely in breast cancer. Canadians have done randomized trials of 5 or 6 weeks of radiation versus just 3. And it seems that if done judiciously, you can get away with 3 weeks of radiation. Now, this is not much of a lower dose of radiation because each day you're giving a little bit more. And from what we understand about the biology of the response of normal tissues to radiation, we worry quite a lot about these large daily doses of radiation. And we worry about the late effects. But there are a number of randomized trials that are cooking, some in the United States, some in Britain, one in Canada, that are comparing your conventional 8 weeks of radiation with 5, with 4, and with even less than that.
And breast, I mean, they're looking at partial breast radiation for 5 days.
Absolutely. And this gets us onto the same issue in prostate cancer. There are now some technologies which allow us to very accurately treat the prostate. They're grouped together under the title stereotactic prostate radiation. And these stereotactic techniques, they take a long time to give the treatment, so you can't have the patient coming again and again and again. So they're limited to about 5 treatments. So there are some hospitals around the country where prostate cancer is being treated in just 5 treatments. And early data, meaning 1, 2, 3 year data, is looking okay. Now, what do I mean by okay? The PSA is coming down, so that's good. And there is no major morbidity yet. And I say yet because most of the morbidity from radiation is late, occurring years down the line. If we look at urinary morbidity from radiation therapy, it's still increasing 10 years down the line. So I think the jury is out on this 5-fraction treatment for prostate cancer.
So let's talk about your cases, which kind of reflect back on some of the things that we've already talked about. Maybe we can start out with your 62-year-old man.
The 62-year-old man who has had a small rise in his PSA over recent years, nothing to feel in his prostate. Biopsy shows a tiny Gleason 6 prostate cancer. This kind of patient is, I think, becoming more thoughtful than ever.
Let me just interrupt you and ask you now, is this an actual person you saw in your practice?
Oh, this is 10 people I see a week.
Can you pick one person like this that
sure.
we can talk about? I don't want to obviously use their name or initials or anything identifying, but I would be curious about your conversation and the man's sort of psychosocial background in terms of how that came into your discussion. Anybody you could pick out?
Absolutely. I can think of somebody who I saw just last week who is this age, and he was the person I did actually have in mind. This is a man who is diagnosed with prostate cancer, a tiny amount of Gleason 6 cancer and 1 biopsy. And with that diagnosis, his world fell apart.
What's his life situation?
He's a lawyer. He was married, but he was divorced about 10 years ago. He does have a girlfriend. He's hoping to marry her.
Children?
He has grown children.
Does he want more?
No, he doesn't want more, which is a very interesting point, which we can come on to in a minute.
So when he saw you, were you the first main physician, or who had he seen before?
No, he'd already spoken with his surgeon, who had said to him, "You are a young man. You're in good health. You better get yourself treated. And we've got just the thing for you. It's a prostatectomy. It's now done by a robot, which makes it minimally invasive. And really, the outcomes are going to be just fabulous."
Now, had he gone out on the web and pulled a lot of information off, or anybody in his family did it?
That was his next maneuver. He, I think, quite wisely chose not to make a snap decision and have a robotic prostatectomy immediately. He went onto the web, and as you know, if you tap in prostate cancer, like tapping in breast cancer, about 3 million sites come up. And he started to scramble around on his own. Some of the sites were authoritative, some of them were not authoritative. But it wasn't long before he came across a couple of technologies that particularly intrigued him. One was proton beam. It's right up there. You Google prostate cancer, I think number 4 or 5 on the list, up pops proton beam. And it was that in particular that he had come to see me about. So I have a patient who is terrified that he's standing on the edge of a cliff with the swirling waters below, about to drop off. He just thought he was going to get his life back in order, marry a new woman who he's met, but now he thinks he's facing death.
And what was his sexual function like?
His sexual function was okay. I mean, I say okay in that he did have erections, he used Viagra, but it was obviously a very important part of his new relationship and cementing that new relationship.
Did his fiancée come with him?
She did. She did. She was very good, very supportive. He was sweating through his consultation with me with anxiety.
Had he had also, as a potential option, active surveillance?
No. It had not been mentioned to him at all. So the first thing I did after the history and the physical was not to launch into a discussion on the subject that he most wanted, which was whether proton beam was right for him, because he'd read on the internet it was, and he'd spoken to people in a support group who said it was perfect. But what we did is we took a gigantic step backwards. Gigantic. And we said, "Whoa, what kind of prostate cancer do you really have?" "A very small one. A very mild one, as far as we can tell from the biopsies." what's likely to happen if we do nothing, nothing at all? And I laid out a scenario where he probably wouldn't experience anything for the next 10 years or 15 years. Maybe he would have some symptoms. He's now 62, so maybe he'd have some symptoms in his late 70s or early 80s. Maybe the disease would catch up with him in his late 80s or early 90s. So all of a sudden, we have a scenario that's unfolding over decades. It seems less urgent to treat the cancer today. And when I explained the notion of active surveillance, which means just watching you, rebiopsying in a year, sequential PSA and sequential digital rectal exam, and treating him down the line if he progressed and demonstrated a need for treatment, and not treating him at all if he never progressed, that all of a sudden seemed very attractive, because you were talking about having biomarkers that will tell us which cancer is aggressive and which isn't. The best marker of all is the test of time. And you actually know by the first rebiopsy. You've got a year's worth of PSA data. The rebiopsy may show that there's the same amount of cancer as before, may not even find the cancer second time around, kind of confirming that at least it was small. And if there has been some progression, there's a little bit of Gleason 7, or maybe 3 or 4 cores are now positive, well, then we can step in and treat him at that stage without any loss.
And what about sexual function, his concern?
Sexual function declines in about 30 to 40% of men over the year or two after treatment, just as it does with all kinds of radiotherapy. And in fact, it could be argued that sexual function will decline in a greater proportion because with the new, more accurate techniques, we're delivering even higher radiation doses. We simply don't know the answer to that yet. So this man had the notion in his head that there will be absolutely no hit on his sexual function, and there really was no risk of any urinary or bowel problems. Now, it's often said that, well, there's no risk of incontinence with proton beam. Well, there's no risk of incontinence with any kind of radiation. That's not the problem with radiation. The problem is a chronic radiation prostatitis, which may lead to frequent and urgent urination. Not incontinence, I grant you, but we'd rather not have it.
I'm still betting that he went on surveillance.
He did. Absolutely.
And how long is it? You just saw him, I guess.
I just saw him. I'll see him in 4 months with a PSA in advance. I will treat him under certain circumstances. I will treat him if his PSA goes up progressively at a rate I don't like. And you can say, what is that rate? It's hard to quantify. I will treat him if I can feel something in his prostate where I felt nothing before. And I will treat him, and this is the most likely reason for treatment, if down the line, on rebiopsy, I find more cancer.
What about your 72-year-old man?
This is a gent who I treated with radiation for his prostate cancer about 9 or 10 years earlier. He had quite a high-grade cancer. We gave him a short course of hormone therapy at that time. He had doses of radiation that were standard for that time, which are, I think, 72 gray. And he did very well. 4, 5 years passed, his PSA had come down, had stabilized. Then in the 6th year, his PSA started to rise. Not at any great rate, but we're now 9 or 10 years out. His PSA is 5, and he's not very nervous about it because he's had the test of time. He's 72, his PSA is only going up slowly. But his wife is very nervous about it, and she says, look, Doc, in his family, there's so much longevity. They all live into their 90s. There's got to be something you could do to cure him right now.
And what about his sexual function?
His sexual function's gone. Sexual function is not an issue for him.
What about sexual interest?
Sexual interest is still there, but it's declined over the years. If you look at the Massachusetts study of aging, you find that by the age of 70, only around 30% of men still have useful spontaneous erections. Now, you know, with the help of Viagra, more men are having sex than those numbers would suggest. But by the time you get to 80, very few men have erections. So this man is between 70 and 80, and he's firmly on the declining curve, speeded by radiation.
Just to be clear, though, based on data or your own clinical experience, I mean, do you find that men who don't have erectile function generally don't have sexual function, or are there other ways they express it?
Well, younger men who don't have erectile function but retain interest are deeply frustrated. And, I mean, they can still have a sexual relationship with their partner. It's obviously got to take a new form. And most men who retain their interest seek other ways of having erections. If not the new PDE5 inhibitor drugs, they'll try alprostadil injections or even have a penile implant inserted. A lot of men, by the time they reach their 70s, if they haven't had erections for many years, they kind of almost habituate to the situation and are substantially less frustrated.
And that's sort of like this man?
That's this man. It's not a big issue for him. He just wants to go out, play golf, and be generally healthy. And he doesn't want any treatment that's going to take away from him. So what could we offer him? Well, first of all, is there any local therapy now that might give him a second chance for cure? And the answer is probably not. If he had a Gleason 8 or 9 cancer at the beginning, he more likely than not, though not inevitably, does have micrometastatic disease. So some additional local therapy right now, especially when it carries some real risks, having had radiation previously, doesn't sit well with me. What local therapy could he be offered? Could he have a prostatectomy? Well, he could, except he's now in his 70s, so he's sort of above the glass ceiling for a prostatectomy. And what's more, as a result of his previous radiation, that prostate is sort of fibrosed and densely adherent to his bladder and his rectum, and the risk of incontinence or rectal injury is really quite high.
So what are the types of situations where you think local therapy, I guess prostatectomy in this situation, would increase cure rate?
Well, there are some men in their 50s who chose to have radiation. It's 3, 4, 5 years down the line, their PSA is going up. A rebiopsy is done, and prostate cancer is found within the prostate. They're rescanned, there's no obvious distant disease, and you're left wondering, couldn't we have one more try with a local therapy? The standard local therapy in that situation is what they call a salvage prostatectomy, though it is only for the most highly motivated of men because the morbidity is really quite high. Some new options have emerged over recent years that are much debated but not so often used. One is cryosurgery, freezing the prostate, and the other is HIFU, high-intensity focused ultrasound. So one uses cold, the other uses heat to ablate the prostate. The problem with both of these therapies is the ablation coming on top of the radiation tends to leave men with very poor urinary function. And some of my most miserable patients are those who've had local salvage therapies.
How long ago was it that this happened?
This is a man I've been following for many years. So I treated him 10 years ago. His PSA started going up 4 years ago slowly. The patient himself wants no treatment that will affect his quality of life.
So his original PSA progression was 4 years ago.
Yes.
What about his PSA doubling time?
His PSA 4 years ago was around 1. His PSA now is around 5. So you can work that out. The doubling time's well over a year.
So you've been observing him?
Yes.
How's that been sitting with him?
It's absolutely fine with him. He's had his disease 10 years. He's kind of used to the disease, and he's got the sense that this is a disease that is measured in decades. He also has a real recognition that at 72, he's not immortal. His wife is much more aggressive. We talked about local therapies. He ruled them out. She said, well, then isn't there a pill you could give him or an injection? And yes, of course, we could start hormone therapy tomorrow, and we could make his PSA 0, but will it extend his life? So this raises the important question, when is the right time to start androgen deprivation? And when you start it, how should you give it? For the rest of his life, or just in an intermittent fashion?
What about anti-androgen / bicalutamide monotherapy, say, with breast irradiation?
That is another intriguing possibility. In head-to-head randomized trials, for men who have MX disease, you think they've got metastases, you just can't see it. It seems that LHRH agonists and high-dose bicalutamide compare very, very well. High-dose means 150 milligrams. You get less of the libido effects, you get less of the fatigue, less of the weight gain, and less of the bone loss. In fact, you don't get any bone loss with high-dose bicalutamide.
I mean, do you think people feel different or worse?
I think they feel better on bicalutamide than LHRH agonists.
How about bicalutamide or nothing?
Oh, I think you feel better on nothing.
So you think there are some palpable changes in the quality of life?
Well, the one problem with bicalutamide is that men inevitably get gynecomastia.
Well, that's what I was saying, if you irradiate his breasts.
And we irradiate his breasts, that only cuts it down by about half.
Really?
Yeah. And even in those who don't get gynecomastia, they may get mastodynia, meaning breast tenderness. So it's pretty good, but it's not great. So, you know, it's not that men will get no weight gain, they get less weight gain. It's not they'll get no fatigue, they'll get less fatigue than with an LHRH agonist. But certainly, this is something we consider, high-dose bicalutamide. But then it's a question of when. If his PSA is going up slowly, and I anticipate that by the time he's 75, it'll only be 10 or 15, I'm happy to hold out. I treat under certain circumstances. If that PSA doubling time really starts to shorten, and it may, you know, the curve looks like a broken arrow, then I know trouble is just round the corner. And rather than let him run into trouble, I will treat him now. I would do annual bone scans. And obviously, if anything starts to show up, that's a signal for treatment.
So it's interesting that the two cases you presented, both of them you didn't treat. I think that's pretty interesting.
I think this is a disease where restraint is well rewarded for everyone.
So I look at this situation, and this man maybe wants to go out and play his golf and see you as infrequently as possible, although I guess his wife might feel differently. But I can envision a lot of men in that situation who might want to do something. And it seems like this would be a great window to look at non-toxic experimental agents.
Absolutely. I think that's, from a research point of view, there is no better window. This is a nice, pure situation. You know you've got wonderful backup with androgen deprivation whenever the time comes, and you can play with experimental agents. And this is the period of time when people are looking at vaccine therapies and other novel agents. But we don't have any magnificent results so far, but it's a research opportunity.
So at your place, I mean, you're at Mass General. Do you have trials right now looking at sort of non-toxic biologic therapy in these people?
Well, we've recently closed a trial looking at a fowl pox vaccine that unfortunately came to nothing, but it was used in just this situation. So let's say the PSA starts to rise more rapidly, or the man loses his nerve, or his wife wins. So what therapy should it be? Well, I think we need to pay respect to his quality of life. I think you can make a very strong case for using a high-dose bicalutamide. I think that would be one perfectly reasonable option. The alternative would be to start an LHRH agonist, but to use it in an intermittent fashion. So what I've frequently done is use an LHRH agonist for 6 months, stop, wait and see. And we find that with 6 months of LHRH agonist, the men will then get another 9 to 12 months off the drug. Then the cycle will restart. And so far, the trials that have been done suggest there is absolutely no disadvantage to intermittent therapy as compared with continuous therapy, and there's probably a quality of life advantage.